a real conversation and some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Nathan Romas with you. Today, we are going to be talking all things leadership and the characteristics and qualities that make good leaders. For that, I have retired Lieutenant Colonel Oakland McCullough on the program. Oak, as he's known, is an internationally recognized keynote speaker and the author of the 2021 release, Your Leadership Legacy, Becoming the Leader You Were Meant to Be. Both his leadership talk and his book are based on 40 plus years of leadership experience in combat, peacekeeping operations, disaster relief operations, and in the boardroom. Oak highlights principles that will benefit today's leaders and inspire the leaders of tomorrow in any profession and at any level. So we're happy to have him here. Welcome, Oak.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Nathan. I've been looking forward to this show.
Oh, I'm glad I have a fan. You know what? When we were chatting before, so it'll be a week ago now, I guess.
Yeah.
Or sorry, a couple of weeks. I picked up your book right after that and just blasted through it. Like it was really good. So I want to start off by saying that. And obviously I put up a book review. But I hope people go and pick this up because at least on Amazon Canada, it was like $7.
Yeah.
It wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah, it's not expensive and it's not a hard read. I wanted to make sure of that. I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
I get people all the time who ask me what my book is about. And I said, look, there is no mention of theory in there. I don't talk about leadership theory. I talk about everyday things that everyday leaders can do to help improve their leadership ability.
Yeah. I mean, and just like you said, it's an easy read, but it's applicable to not just, you know, military or law enforcement types. It's right up to people like executives, anyone in management, no matter the industry. The lessons are going to be the same. And we'll get into all of that. Wanted to just start kind of talking a little bit about you and just find out more about you and how you kind of got into the whole leadership aspect of things. So the qualities that you talk about and exhibit, you know, is that something that you were raised with or did you seek those out on your own? So where do you come from and right, develop those qualities?
Yeah, so I grew up in a small little farm town in northern Illinois, which is why I live in Florida, because I'm never living through winters like that ever again. and it was 1,200 people in the town. Everybody knew everybody. I played baseball, basketball, football in high school, most of my life, but in high school. And I was captain of my teams. But I think it really started, you're right, at home. A lot of the things I talk about in my book, my father or my mother taught me as a young kid. But then in high school, I had two really good mentors. My high school basketball coach, Coach Terry Nitzwicki, who I still stay in contact with.
Oh, wow.
Who absolutely was a servant leader. You know, he understood that it wasn't just his job to produce a good basketball team. It was to help these young men that he was in charge of, helping to develop, to help develop them into people that were going to be productive members of society, good husbands, good fathers, good people. And he did a good job of that. And then my high school history teacher, who I kept in touch with up until about 2 months ago when he died, was the same way. He was a Vietnam veteran, Army veteran. And I majored in history in college because of him. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he developed a love of history in me. And he was a good mentor. He was somebody who I could always go to and ask questions of. And then had some really good servant leader mentors or bosses, leaders in the Army that kind of cemented that for me, that these are the things you got to do to be a good leader. I had some authoritarian micromanaging leaders in the Army as well.
But, oh, yeah.
those weren't the ones I wanted to emulate.
Do you think, is there anything in particular, maybe like one or two characteristics that really stand out about those people? Like, is it the passing on of wisdom, or are they telling you to act in a certain way? Like, is right. there is there something specific that you think is kind of like the thing that you really resonated with?
Yeah, two things, really. I think number one, set the example in everything you do every day. You know, be that moral, ethical, lawful, good person leader that's doing, trying to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because people are checking on you or watching you. They are checking on you and they are watching you, but that's not why you should do the right thing. You do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And that's what good leaders do. And then the other piece of it is, I think it's kind of a combination of getting to know you. And the reason that I think good servant leaders like to get to know the people they have the privilege to lead, and it is a privilege to lead people, is because then, you know, you understand them a little bit and you have a little, you can have more empathy for them. And you know, when I use that word, there's a lot of people who say, who really don't know what it means. They think that means you feel sorry for them or you let them do whatever they want to do, or it means you understand where they're coming from. And then you can make decisions based on that. Because everybody has things that are going on in their personal life that impact us at work and everywhere else. So the more you know about a person, the more you can take those things into account to help them be better and to help them get over some of those things that are confronting them in their personal life.
Well, yeah, and you know what? That's a good point. That I've had that come up with pretty much anybody I've talked to on kind of the leadership or management, and it's worldwide. So I've had a guest on from Australia, from Ghana. When we're talking about how to make people better, it always comes back to enabling themselves to have some control over their own life.
That's right.
Agency, the ability, you know, get their own skills and abilities up so that they can make themselves better or other people, right? When you're in a good spot, then you can kind of pass it on to others.
Right.
So the definition of leadership, you had this in the book. You had a whole number of them. It's kind of interesting. So you have a lot of definitions in there. The one that you use is from the U.S. Army. And I was comparing that to our police service, and it's pretty much the same definition.
Sure.
So it talks a lot about motivating other people to accomplish a mission and improve the organization. Do you find that maybe is it motivation? And I kind of want to get onto like motivation and versus manipulation.
Right.
And what exactly, when you talk about motivation, how to motivate people, you know, is there a difference between that as opposed to manipulation?
Yeah, I think there is. I think motivation is the pure form of it. I mean, I think they're both motivation. You know, you can motivate somebody by manipulating them, but that's not, again, that's not doing the right thing. That's not being a good leader, in my opinion. And I've worked with people who did that. I think the motivation piece is because you want a good leader should want to make the people that they're leading better. And so part of that, it's not just to motivate them to do a good job at work, but it's to motivate them to be better people. I believe that.
Yeah.
And what I tell people, the easiest way to, you know, because it isn't reward and punishment. That's not how you motivate people. Not in the real world. I mean, that's, you know, I think I said in my book, and I certainly say it in my talk, that's how you train dogs, is reward and punishment. And that doesn't mean you don't reward the people that deserve it. You don't punish the people that deserve it, because you have to do that as a leader. I mean, that's part of your job. But that's not what motivates them. What motivates them is a sense of purpose. We all want a sense of purpose in our life. That's whether that's in our personal life or at work. We want that sense of purpose that kind of keeps us centered on what it is that we want to accomplish. And I think two ways you do that as a leader. Number one, you learn a little bit about the person you're leading. What are their goals? What do they want to accomplish?
Okay.
What are, you know, 5 years from now, where do they see themselves? Where do they want to be? Do they want to be a leader, or are they happy just working their 8 hours, drawing their paycheck and going home? I mean, and that's fine if that's what they want, but you as a leader should know what the people you're leading want, so you can help the ones that want to get better and be better people and help your organization be better if that's what they want to do. And then, and I tell people a good way to figure out what motivates people is to figure out what that sense of purpose is for them. Mm. And usually you can tie that back to what makes your organization unique, because that's probably why they joined your organization in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, again, there's some people who just joined it for a paycheck. I got that. But I don't think most people are that way. Most people join, they choose what profession they want to go into. They choose which organization they want to join. And then usually it's whatever makes that organization unique. Now, in the Army, first responders, policemen, firemen, EMTs, that is pretty easy to figure out what motivates people. You know, when I was in the Army, never had a problem motivating my soldiers.
Yeah.
But look, we support and defend the Constitution of the United States. We defend the American way of life. We win our nation's wars. Let's go. Motivated. Mm-hmm. When I took over the food bank, that didn't work. But go figure.
You have a good example in the book about this too.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to circle back and figure out what it was that motivated them to come work for you. And usually it's whatever makes your organization unique. If you can figure that out, that usually has always helped me motivate people.
Yeah, I was, you know, in coming up with some of the ideas for our discussion here, and I'm thinking about motivation and the manipulation part. And I almost looked at it like a good and evil, right? And motivation, like you're saying, you're trying to give people kind of a more intrinsic value, the sense of purpose and meaning. Whereas I find manipulation is something that you do see in management quite a bit. I feel like it's quite a bit.
Yeah.
I think it's just, it's easy for people to think I have to just do the reward punishment. Like it's almost a lazy approach.
It is.
Yeah. And it's not a good way to get people.
Well, they don't have to get to know you. They
yeah.
don't have to figure out what it is that you want out of life. They just assume, or they don't care what you want, or they assume that they know what you want, that you just want more money. And that's not generally what drives people.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we all got to make money. I got that. But that's not what generally drives people. It is a sense of purpose.
Yeah. I think, you know, you'll see people in the organization, whatever organization you're in, flock to the good leaders, right? The ones that actually care. People can tell when you care.
Well, and you can't fake it.
Yeah. You know, you give time, you also speak on actually listening to your people, not just waiting for your turn to talk or whatever it might be. It's actually listening, taking that in and responding back to them, right? Summarize, paraphrase, all those things, but showing that you really care about them. One of the things you talked about as well was when you speak to the younger generation, so you go into schools and talk to the kids there, and you ask what they want to be in the future, and they say leaders. And it kind of comes across as like a very superficial, they're just like, they just throw it out like, yeah, I want to be a leader. I don't know if they just associate that with like, that means I'm going to be a CEO and make a lot of money.
Right.
But when you ask any kind of drill down question, so you go one or two layers deep, they don't really have a response. You're like, okay, well, what is a leader? And then they just sit there and go,
Yeah.
So
yeah, they really don't know.
So how do you explain to them, you know, how to answer those questions, I guess, but also what a leader is and what they should really aspire to be?
Yeah. So to me, it's again, circle back to servant leadership, that it's not about you. You know, it shouldn't be about, you shouldn't want to be the leader because you're going to get a nice title and you're going to get more privileges and make more money and live in a nicer house and drive a nicer car. Leaders get those things generally, and that's okay. But if that's the only reason you want to be a leader, then please go do something else. You're not going to be a good one. You're not going to be a good one. And I always just kind of caveat it with this phrase, it's not about you and it's all about you. Again, it's not about those privileges and titles and all that kind of stuff. It's about how you treat the people you have the privilege to lead. And then everything else is based on that. How do you do that? How do you take care of the people that you're leading. You're good, you know, improve your communication skills. You do a better job of problem solving, of especially their problems, mm-hmm. you know, but that's part of what a leader does. Now, you don't take that problem on as your own problem, but you help them solve that problem. And that's another issue that I see a lot today is leaders want to take on everybody's problem. You can't do that. That doesn't solve anything.
Well,
but you can help them. But everything that you do as a leader should go back to being a servant leader, taking care of the people that you have the privilege to lead.
Yeah, you know, we often have these discussions in my own organization within our own group, or I'll talk to, you know, some of my peers, and we talk about, you know, as a constable, so I'm the lowest rank, what do I need just my sergeant to do? And it's like, well, kind of be a bit of a shit umbrella when complaints and things come in. But also if we need certain resources or certain equipment, you know, that's the person I have to go to, and I need them to fight the battles upwards.
That's right.
But I need them to like listen to some of our problems and help us fight the good fight. So kind of what you're speaking to there, you can find people who don't take the time to do that, and they're just, I don't know, working on their next promotion or doing things for themselves, right? Like, hey, I got this brilliant idea. You're all going to do it. And then I'm going to put on my resume, say I created this cool flow chart or whatever job or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can immediately tell when somebody has your best interests at heart. So just kind of speaking about the leaders and the future leaders, I guess, how do you know when you are a leader? So is it like being cool? Someone has to tell you you're cool for you to be cool? Or is it just... is it like kind of a thought and feeling process? And you're like, hey, people are coming to me.
Right.
They're seeking out my advice. They're seeking out, you know, hey, that person can make some things happen, you know, reputation wise. So how do you know you're a leader?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things. I think, first of all, I think, you know, I get asked this question all the time. Are leaders made or are they taught?
Yeah.
And I think there's a combination. I think people are born. Some people are born with inherent leadership abilities, or it develops quicker on its own. And if you don't believe me, go out to any playground with a bunch of 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds out there playing. There's somebody in charge.
Yes.
There's a kid that every other kid is following, I promise you. And nobody's made that person, that kid, a leader, but everybody's following that kid. So there are natural leaders out there, I think. But I think to answer your question, I think that it's a combination of things. I think you realize that you kind of become a leader when, number one, people come to you with problems because they know you can help them solve it. You know, and General Colin Powell, who's probably still the most impressive man, well, not probably, he is still the most impressive man I've ever met in person. I had a quote that I loved, and I don't know if I put it in. I think I put it in the book. If you're a leader and your people stop coming to you with your problems, you're no longer their leader.
Yeah,
because that's part of being a leader, and that's how you kind of know when people are coming to you. The people that you're leading are coming to you with problems, then they have accepted you as their leader because they realize that you can help them solve those problems. The other thing that I think is then top down, when your bosses, the leaders above you, are coming to you because they know that you can get something done, and they give you all the tough jobs, they give you the hardest tasks to accomplish because they have faith that you can lead your organization to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other piece of that is the mentor piece of it. You know, when you have people who want you to be their mentor, you know, and I've been lucky in my last 15 years associated with the Army, I had my hand in commissioning over 580 lieutenants for the United States Army and for this country. And a lot of those stay in contact with me. You know, they'll not every day, not every month, maybe not even every year, but every so often, one of them will either have a problem that they want some advice on, or they just send me a message saying, hey, sir, I just got promoted. or I'm moving to this duty station, or I've got this option of two duty stations. Which one would you recommend?
Yeah.
I mean, things like that, that kind of make you realize that you were, they recognized you as their leader, as a leader in their life. And so I think there's a combination of things when you can finally figure out that maybe you got the leadership piece right.
Yeah. Well, and you know what, you brought up a good point that I actually didn't even think about. I was thinking this whole conversation in the leadership, it's generally you are above a bunch of people and you're leading them, but you also, leadership also incorporates the people above you and getting jobs done for them,
yeah.
But also, I guess, speaking truth to power, which is one of the topics I was going to ask you about. So maybe we'll kind of go there. How do you know which fights, or which battles to pick? Because I feel like with my own experiences in the last few years, there's been a lot of battles at work, but how do you know which ones to pick, and how do you avoid burnout? Because it is super exhausting trying to fight upward and downward battles. So what would be some advice on that?
Yeah, and I mean, there are people who tell you I didn't do a good job of picking and choosing the ones. That's probably why I retired a lieutenant colonel. but having said that, my philosophy was always this. If it was something that was right, absolutely black and white, it was right to do what needed to be done, then I fought that fight. If it went against my morals, my ethics, where I wouldn't like who I saw in the mirror the next morning when I was shaving, then that was when I had to fight. Mm. So I think if you follow those two, if it's the right thing to do, and it's morally there's a moral question, ethical question, then you got to fight those. The rest of them, you got to kind of figure out if it's worth the price that you might have to pay to fight it. For me, all the ones that I fought that I think that I probably didn't do my career any justice, for me, they were those two. They were something that was the right thing to do and a couple that I thought were ethical issues that I felt like I couldn't play that game. I couldn't, for the betterment of my career, I couldn't say yes.
Do you think, and another topic we'll get onto a bit later, but do you think there's an element of fear in there for some people who...
Oh, absolutely there are.
Yeah, like people who choose, even if it's not the right decision, it's like, well, I'm still going to do this because my ass is on the line and like I don't want that to happen. So
yeah, and you know, I got it. I mean, people have a family that's depending on them for their paycheck, whatever, to bring home the money. And they're afraid if they go against what the boss is saying, that the boss is going to fire them. That's got to be a personal decision. If you can live with that decision, okay, I guess that's okay with you. But you get, like I said, the thing that I always fell back on was, am I going to like who I see in the mirror the next morning?
Yeah.
And if the answer was no, then I couldn't do it. No matter what, even if it cost me, you know, a promotion or my next pay raise or whatever, I just couldn't do it.
Do you think, is there a way to train people to, I don't even know if it's like their thought process, but it's just to manage fear in that sense? Like, can you, and maybe I'll clarify a bit more. The way I kind of look at it is, you know, if it's something where you're going to get fired for, okay, don't get fired. Don't get fired, but you need to find another way to make things happen, right? There's always more than one path. But if it's simply just, hey, you know, I've got this boss that I don't necessarily get along with. They want me to implement something or do something that is, you know, it's not going to be a popular decision and nobody likes it. And maybe it's completely stupid or it just doesn't make sense. You know, can I go against that? And, you know, say, hey, we shouldn't be doing that, or, you know, figuring out a way to talk to your boss. But
yeah, I think that's it. I think, you know, in those situations, and we've all been there, you know, I always say, you know, we've all worked for the good idea fairy. yeah. and maybe that some of those ideas weren't good. And, you know, but they come up with this idea and they want to implement it. And look, we all have a boss. And you as the middle leader or junior leader, somebody behind, underneath that boss, you still got to got some responsibilities. One, you got to do, if what that boss is asking you to do is not illegal, immoral, or unethical, yeah. then you've got two choices. Either you do it or you quit. But if you're not going to quit, which most people won't over those situations, and I didn't when it was one of those types, and I had plenty of dumb ideas that my bosses pushed on us, then you have two responsibilities. Number one, to let the boss know, maybe in a more politically correct way than I ever did, that it may not be the right answer. It may not be the best way to do something, you know, and just say, throw out some other ways that you can think of to do it. Hey, boss, that I got it, but maybe we can do this, or there may be other ways to do it, and throw out a couple ways to do it. They may say, great, and let's pick that one, or they may say, shut up and go do what I told you to do, and then you got to make that decision. But then the other piece of that is, which I think a lot of leaders today abdicate,
yeah.
is that you need to be, like you said, that umbrella that is trying to shield the people under you. You can't shield them from everything, but you've got to kind of be that buffer that says, okay, and this is the worst thing I see, and I see it a lot. They'll go back to their people that they're leading and say, I don't agree with this, but the boss says we got to do it, so we're going to do it.
Mm.
Horrible
yeah.
as a leader. When you make the decision, you're going to do whatever the boss tells you to do. Now you own it as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sorry, you don't get to say, well, that's the boss's responsibility. As a leader, once you say, yeah, okay, I'm going to do this, then you take ownership on it as well. And so then you got to just make the best of it and try to shield as much of the negative stuff as you can from the people that you're leading.
Yeah, so I guess some of the advice there too is learning how to say no, but being nice about it speaking to.
And I think if you throw out ideas, rather than just say, no, that's a stupid idea, you can say, okay, I got it, but are there some other ways we can do it? Here's a couple other options. And maybe, you know, that at least then the person who's leading you can at least, now he or she has an out. They can either say, yes, let's look at those, or they can say, no, I've looked at those already, and this is the way we're going to do it. Now you got to make that choice. Are you going to do it, or are you
going
to quit?
I like how you put that, like giving them an out, because if you come in and just say no, well, one, you look like you're insubordinate.
Yeah.
But also, if they start to realize maybe that isn't a great idea, and you've kind of presented a couple solutions, they can go, yeah. I like this is my idea now. and you know, you manipulate them into it. No.
Yeah. So, well, none of us have all the right answers, and we're all going to make dumb decisions. And, you know, a good leader will appreciate somebody who walks in and says, you know, boss, maybe that's not the best way to do this, and I've thought about it, and here's a couple other ways that we could do it. Or we can take a little bit of each one of those, but that just probably isn't the best way to do it from my vantage point. Now, again, they got a different vantage point than you do.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're being told they don't have a choice either in what they're doing. So, you know, you got to take all that into account. But I think if you can at least give them options that still accomplish the big picture of what it is they want to accomplish, just not in the same way, that then, like I said, then they have, at least then have options that, you know, rather than you just saying, nope, I'm not doing it.
Kind of still on the topic of fear. So instead of just talking about speaking to, you know, truth to power and fear among those decisions, what about fear of failure? So when you're talking to subordinates and you're the one with the bright idea that you're trying to
yes.
motivate people to get to do things or accomplish a certain mission, and you're going to own that. So how do you deal with the fear of being completely wrong. Or, I mean, even in military or law enforcement context, sometimes your decisions put people's lives on the line. So,
but even successful decisions do that.
Yes.
So that's what you really got to remember. You know, the way I entered being a leader in the Army was that if I did everything right and I made all the right decisions, somebody still might die.
Yeah, it's true.
Including me. That's just the nature of the beast that first responders, military are in. Now, most leaders don't have that responsibility, thank goodness, although some do. You know, the heavy industry where safety, there's a lot of safety issues. And if you make a bad decision, somebody's going to die. But, you know, to me, a good leader doesn't let the people under them fail. You can let them make mistakes, but a good leader will step in and not let a complete failure happen. And I've had bosses who have stepped in and helped me kind of steer away from those type of things. So I think that's a good lesson to learn is that, you know, if you are a leader, you gotta let people do things the way they want to do it. You know, you give them the big picture, you give them all the, like you said, the resources, the time, money, people, equipment, whatever. And then you get out of their way and let them do it. And then, but yet you don't wash your hands of it. You're still there to answer questions, to give advice, to, you know, if you see things starting to go off the rail, you can say, don't tell them how to do it, but say, okay, I've seen it done this way, a couple different ways. And then give them the option of what they want to use to kind of get it back on track. But failure is a huge fear, but so is success. And I've known people who are afraid of succeeding, which boggles my mind, but I've known them. But I think you just have to face your fear that, okay, I'm gonna make mistakes and it's not always gonna work out, but if it doesn't work out, then two things. I admit I made a mistake. And number two, we reflect on it so that we learn from it. Because you don't learn from experience. Experience doesn't teach you anything. The reflection on that experience is what you learn from.
Okay.
That's how you learn from experiences and mistakes, is you look back on them and say, okay, what was I supposed to do? What did we do? And how can we get better at it? That's how you learn from experience.
How do you think, especially when you're dealing with subordinates, how do you avoid micromanaging? So you give them those options, and whether you're a helicopter parent or a helicopter commander, whatever, but yeah. How do you, you know, let them go and make their errors? So at what level do you think it becomes micromanaging? And you know, I think this is really applicable to a lot of the military law enforcement context, because we have, you know, from my own experience, we could be holding containment on a threat. And then you start getting, some commanders will start saying like, I want you to stand right here and I want you to go right there. And you're like, none of this makes sense because you're not on the ground or in this building. Like, I'm going to stand where I'm not going to die. So, you know, when it comes to the micromanaging side, how do you know when you're starting to micromanage?
Yeah. When you start making decisions, like you said, number one, when you're not on the ground, you don't know the situation. So how can you make decisions? And number two, when you start taking the responsibility for the decisions that are being made away from the people on the ground, the ones that are there, who see what's going on, whose lives are on the line, or a limb, you know, in the business, in the industry world, industrial world, or whatever.
Yeah.
Or just who are there and have the experience and know what they're talking about and what they're doing. And, you know, the way I've always avoided micromanaging is, and, you know, I didn't come up with this. Somebody taught it to me. You know, they said, look, you know, you give the big picture. This is what I want it to look like at the end. Then you give them the resources, You give them the authority to make it happen, and then you get out of their way and you let them do it. Again, you don't wash your hands of it, but you let them do it. And if they're struggling, you make sure they know that they can always come and ask advice or another option to do it or something like that. But they know they can come back to you because that is where creativity happens.
Yeah.
When you're using their skills, their knowledge, their abilities. Because I don't care how long you've been doing what you're doing, you don't have all the knowledge and all the skills and all the abilities. Somebody's better at you than something. I mean, I promise, it's just the way it is. And I think, you know, the analogy I always use when I talk about that is that if the big picture is you got to get to 9, then 7 plus 2 is 9, but so is 6 plus 3 and 5 plus 4 and 8 plus 1. How do you care how they get to 9? You just got to get to 9.
Yeah.
Let them figure out how to do that.
One of the things I was thinking too is like communication is key. But when you're in those like, those situations where it's like go now or we're in the middle of something, sometimes too much communication is not great. And then I think sometimes commanders, as they get more and more stuff coming in, it's just flowing. I feel like they're getting overwhelmed. So they feel like they need to control more. Either bring things down to their speed or whatever it might be. Or you start giving too much info and maybe they're like, I really don't know what they're talking about or what this looks like. So they start, wanting more of that control.
Right.
It's almost like you have to have a good balance of somewhere in the middle, not too much, not too little communication. Too little is obviously not good for a million reasons. So, right. I think, everybody just kind of one communicating, but also not taking things personal when, a subordinate or someone above you says, hey, this isn't going to work, or that's a bad idea. You know, we're just all trying to get home alive at the end of the night. So, yeah.
So I think you're absolutely right. I think that there is a spectrum, and depending on where you are in the situation you're in, depends on how wide that spectrum gets. You know, I always say, when you have time, then you should call in as many of your subordinate leaders that you can to get ideas, to get their opinions, to try to get use as much of their skills and knowledge as possible. When you're in a hot situation and you don't have that much time, then it's you making decisions. And, again, you are probably going to have to make a decision based on not all the information that you would like to have.
Yeah.
Because we've all worked for that person who couldn't make a decision because they didn't have all the information they wanted. Well, I'm sorry, that's called fantasy land, that place where you get all the information you want. It doesn't exist usually, especially not in first responder professions. So, you figure out as the leader to keep from being paralyzed, you figure out what it is you know. You try to figure out what you don't know. You make a good educated guess on that. And then you come up with a plan and you implement it. You can always make changes as things go along. But I think the other piece of that is that even once you make that decision, you still got to give some leeway to the people under you that are executing it. Because again, they know what the big picture is supposed to look like.
Yeah.
So if the plan you came up with to execute, somehow something changes and that they're not going to be able to get to 9 unless they go around something, then you got to give them that leeway to make that happen. And I see the good leaders do. Bad leaders say, nope, that's not the plan. Stick with the plan.
Yeah.
They know for sure it isn't going to get them where they want to be.
Well, I wonder too how you develop that courage in the leadership ranks or in the management ranks to make them good leaders. I guess you should word it that way. Because courage, like you're even saying, when you look at kids on a playground, and you can tell sometimes there's like a natural leader in there, but is that more just like ignorance of fear at that age? they don't know all the bad things that could happen for whatever decision they're making, or are they exhibiting courage? So I wonder at higher levels, like once you have all these life experiences, You know, does that make people more afraid? They shy away from decisions because they're thinking, I don't want this to happen to me. I don't want to lose that promotion. I don't want to get, a negative review or whatever it might be. Or is it more so, some other factor that just leads to them not being able to have courage? I think that's the big thing that it comes up, whether you're making decisions and you're trying to delegate things to subordinates, or you're trying to speak up the chain of command and hoping, somebody doesn't bite your head off for it. So,
yeah, well, I think personal courage, because that's what we're talking about, really, not physical courage, not facing somebody who's going to shoot you. I mean, we all got to develop that as well. But what we're talking about is personal courage, the courage to do the right thing and to make good decisions and to understand that there are consequences to decisions we make. Every decision has a consequence. Every single one we make has a consequence, good or bad. So you got to understand that, and you got to really work toward getting to the point in your life where you make decisions that give you good consequences and the people that work for you good consequences. Again, understanding that even a good decision could sometimes cost somebody something. I mean, that's the way of life. But I think that comes with more experience. The more experience you have in making decisions, the better you get at, one, guessing what you don't know and making a good guess at that, and the flexibility to allow change to the plan once it happens. But that comes with experience. The people who are micromanagers and leaders that are micromanagers in my experience are the ones that have less experience being a leader.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Even somebody who, in the Army, I worked for a colonel, full bird colonel, when I was a captain, who was an absolute micromanager. Now, he made colonel, but when you trace back the leadership positions he had to get there, he didn't have a whole lot of leadership positions to get to that rank, however he got to that rank. But and I think we're seeing that in today's, at least in the American Army, we're seeing a lot of that as well. When I was a lieutenant, I had 36 months of platoon time where I was in charge of 30 something guys. I had two company commands. So I had 26, 27 months of company command time. I did 2 years as an S3. So 24 months of being an operations officer in charge of the day-to-day operations of the armor battalion. Today, platoon leaders are lucky if they get 12 months. Company commanders get one company and then they're moving on. So we're promoting people to the rank of lieutenant, colonel, and colonel who don't have the leadership experience of guys like when I was that age.
Yeah.
And I think it shows bad decisions, micromanaging, and people who are just concerned about their next pay raise and their next promotion.
One thing I was going to ask, we kind of touched on maybe different parts to this, but when you get people who are kind of fed up with the system or the organization, and then you see now we have like all kinds of whistleblowers, and whether that's in intelligence or in military or police, and kind of on this same thread, something I listened to with Jocko in his podcast, he talked about playing the game. So are you more effective? I think his point essentially was, are you more effective inside the organization or fighting, whatever it is from outside the organization?
Right.
What are your, I was curious to get your thoughts on this. So, if you think you're kind of in a jam in whatever branch you're in or with whatever chain of command or whoever your CEO and bosses are, is it better to stay within and play the game, like we talked about? Can you stomach some of the decisions and live with yourself?
Yeah.
Or
that's the key to me.
That's okay.
That's the key. If you can, because you certainly can be more effective inside the organization than outside, for the most part, unless you can get the publicity and the you know, the airtime that some of these that have gotten that were outside the organization. You know, and the one that comes to mind is the Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel who made the decision that he couldn't stomach what was going on anymore, and basically gave up his retirement and everything else at, you know, 19 years. So, you know, and he has certainly gotten some airtime and some, you know, he wrote a book and he's been on a lot of podcasts and a lot of shows and that. So maybe he can do some work, some good on the outside, but most people can't. But you got to, it really comes down to if you can live with the things you got to do to stay inside. And at some point, maybe you can't. And that's when you got to say, okay, it's not worth it to me to play the game for my next promotion. Or I guess the flip side is who you're helping by staying in, maybe. But again, in the end, you're going to leave that organization, because we all do one way or another. And then you still got to live with it for the rest of your life, things that you did.
Yeah.
So that's really what it's got down to.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people get kind of sick of hearing, and you mentioned this in the book a bunch, some of the management will say, you know, that's how things have always been done. So that's why we just keep doing what we're doing. And I just, three kind of thoughts that came to mind when I was reading that is like, it's either safe, they're lazy, or it's just out of habit. Humans are creatures of habit.
Yeah. Or probably
or all three. Yeah.
Probably all.
So I can see.
Well, you know, here's the thing that I always believed in, and I always tried to make the people who worked for me in any organization that I led understand. Look, rules are there for a reason. And if you're going to break a rule, then it should be for a good reason. But rules should never, ever prevent you from taking care of somebody that you have responsibility for. If you got to break a rule because it makes sense in helping somebody that you're leading, then you break the rule. That was always my philosophy. And I went as far as, you know, I had a HRA, a human resource assistant, who said, "Sir, you can't do that." And I said, "Well, we're going to do it." I said, "And here's a memo signed by me saying that I made you do it, so that anybody ever comes back and looks at you and says, 'Why did you do this?' you can pull this out and say, 'He made me do it.'"
Yeah.
Because I was the one who made that decision. But it was the right thing to do. And I refused to. Laws are a different thing. I got that. But rules were made. Maybe that rule was made 50 years ago and doesn't even matter anymore, or doesn't pertain anymore. So you always have to, for rules, you always have to look at what's in the best interest of the people you're leading.
Yeah. So one of the things, just kind of as we come up to the end of our time, just talking about some of the solutions that are out there, you talk a lot about modeling behavior for people when you're caring for them, but especially when you're caring for them. You know, and I think we've touched on a lot of this throughout our conversation. You know, do you have any kind of final thoughts on, you know, how to just make sure that you are showing that those leadership characteristics and making sure that you are actually taking care of your people? I want to say that, you know, there's like the courage element we talked about, putting your, you know, so sometimes you have to sacrifice something of yourself.
Yeah.
To get something ahead. But any kind of final thoughts or something maybe we didn't cover on the modeling side of it?
Yeah. So I think first of all, it starts at home. Mm. You know, because you can't fake this. You can't fake caring for people. You can't fake being, you know, doing things with integrity and character and those kind of things. Because eventually somebody's going to figure it out. And when they do, then you're done as a leader.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. The trust is gone. So I think, you know, one, it's us teaching young men and women, at, you know, our kids to live that lifestyle. And my wife and I tried to do that with our kids for more than I did because I was gone so much. But then you personally have to live that even off work. You know, one of the things they say is you're the leader 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Just because you leave your job, you're no longer not the leader. You're still the leader. You're just at home with your family or at a ball game or whatever you're doing, but you're still the leader. And the things that you do and the way you act and how you can present yourself still reflects on you being a leader. So I think we got to internalize that piece of it. And it really does have to be a lifestyle, not just a work.
Yeah. Thing. You know what, actually you bring up a really good point, is the modeling it, like, you know, fixing your own house, I guess, or looking inward before going out. I think it was one of the examples you had was, I forget the guy's name, but he would get up from his desk, kind of do like the small circle.
General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower.
Yeah, so the example you give, I thought that is one that resonated with me, and I was like, man, that's...
Yeah, look at yourself first. Yes. If there's a problem or an issue, look at yourself, because you might be causing that problem as the leader. A lot of times it is you. Mm-hmm. So you got to fix yourself before you can fix other people or help other people fix themselves. You can't fix other people. But you can help them do it. So I think that's key. It really does start with you, the leader, and then everything else radiates out of that.
Yeah. And you know, I think people will see very quickly, as you mentioned, if you're not able to kind of exhibit those characteristics in your own life, because, you know, you're going to tell stories about things you're doing at home or with your family, and people go like, what the hell are you doing there? You know, you're telling us to behave a certain way here. Yeah. I think it's like, yeah, you have to have a good foundation for yourself. I also think it's very difficult to help other people when, you know, you aren't fixing your own house first. Just, you have to be in a good place in order to help others. Otherwise, you know, you got too much invested in yourself, too many resources that you have to take up yourself. So I think it makes it difficult.
Yeah, I agree.
The other one last thing I want to ask about was just on core competencies. So you talk about the leadership acronym, and just, I always wonder how effective these really are or where they come up. So it seems like maybe it comes up a little more in the military sense. From my own experience, we kind of see it when you're getting hired and maybe on a test. Yeah. They'll ask you to kind of regurgitate them. And then you don't see it again. Like, I'm 12 years in and I know it's painted on a wall somewhere in one of the buildings. But, you know, how do you get people to constantly do these things or exhibit those qualities? Because it almost seems like an afterthought once it leaves the test world or whatever you're applying for something. So
yeah,
how good are these things? How useful?
So I think they are useful in the beginning. You know, when you are helping to develop that leader at a young age, to at least give them a tool to think back on what it is that they need to demonstrate, that they need to live by. I think you're absolutely right. I think once they move on beyond that, you know, when I was a lieutenant colonel, I didn't think about the acronym leadership. I mean, because by that point, I hope for most people at that point, it's ingrained in you and your mind automatically thinks about things that are going to fit inside that acronym. But I think acronyms are overused a lot of times, or the importance of them are overused. But I think in the beginning, they're important because, you know, as you're bringing new people into the organization, that's part of your job as a leader, is to bring them into the culture. Uh-huh. And that's what we're talking about with that acronym leadership. We're talking about it, the culture of the American Army or the Canadian Police Force or whatever it is that you are there, and that acronym that you're using is to help develop them in a way or bring them into the culture of that organization. Once you've done that, and once they understand that that's what is expected of them, then they don't think about it that much anymore. They don't think every time they're making a decision, let's see, leadership. Yeah, falls under this one, and I got to make sure. Because once they're ingrained in the culture, it should be automatic what they should do. You know, and I always tell people, look, the things you need to do as a leader are not hard.
Yeah.
Doing them is the hard part.
Yeah.
You know, because the principles of leadership are pretty easy. And the things that you need to do are pretty easy. Actually doing them, making yourself do them, making yourself make those tough decisions, making yourself not micromanage people, because it's hard.
Yes.
Not to micromanage people. I got it. You know, you assign somebody a task that you know you could do in 15 minutes and they're struggling. It's going to take them all day to do what you could have done in 15 minutes. It's tough not to walk up and say, get out of my way. But you have to. Those are the tough things you got to do as a leader. And so I think you're right. I think that a lot of what you can't put too much emphasis on that at some point. I think it's important in the beginning. But then the importance of those acronyms go down as you go along. They're still important, but not as something you push in somebody's face every day, because they should have already made that part of themselves.
Yeah.
At that point. And at that point, then you don't gain anything by throwing it up there again.
Well, and that goes back to the implementing it in your own life, right? And then it just becomes kind of part of your foundation, your core. And then you can just kind of carry that with you through those leadership steps. So we're just coming up to the end of the time. I want to give you the opportunity to say how people can, find your book, but also follow you and your work.
Yeah, so my book is on Amazon. It is available hardcover, paperback, ebook, Audible. And I did the reading on the Audible book. The only other voice on there is my wife's. She did the foreword because she wrote the foreword for the book. And she read about the author. Everything else is my voice on there. And I have a website, www.ltcoakmccullough.com. And on there, it has not only a link to the Amazon book site, but it also has some prior podcasts I've been on. It's got couple of videos from my speaking engagements on there, and it has links to all the social media that I'm on, because I'm on all of them, unfortunately.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is.
It's a lot of work being on all these platforms.
Well, you know, and I really use LinkedIn. That's how we connected, was on LinkedIn. That's the one I use the most. So if you really want to connect with me on LinkedIn, and that's the easiest way to connect with me, probably.
Awesome. Well, I'll encourage people to go pick up the book. It's called Your Leadership Legacy, Becoming the Leader You Were Meant to Be. And I'll remind people, share, like, comment, the Quiet Professional Podcast, trying to spread the message and make people better leaders all the other topics we're talking about on here. So go out, educate yourselves, and become just better people overall. I just want to say thanks to Oak for taking his time to come on the show today and all the experiences that he shares throughout the book. It's applicable not just in the law enforcement, first responder, military sense, but corporate world. It's the one thing I commend the military for is they're very good at putting things into acronyms, but also making things concise and a little bit to the point. So it's applicable across life. So thank you, Oak. And just hang on the line for 2 seconds. We'll chat offline.
Okay. Thanks for having me on the show, Nathan.